This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. I'm your host, David Brett. And on today's show,
we discuss the tempestuous relationship between the US and China. What's the beef?
Well, part of the issue is that China threatens to dislodge America from its position as the world's largest economy.
How effective has the US response been?
Not very. I would say not particularly effective, to be honest. Certainly, it's hard to argue that trade tariffs have been a particularly potent weapon.
And the potential consequences of the relationship souring further.
Pandemonium, I think, is the short answer.
Relations between the US and China are strained. China's challenging the global dominance of the US.
This is a genuine Thucydidean and rivalry between a rising China and a ruling US, in which China's rise threatens to displace the US from the position of leadership that it's enjoyed in the world for 70 years. So that's what's happening.
A decoupling of economic and political ties between the US and China is likely to be one of the most important drivers of financial markets during the next decade. Ever since Donald Trump swept to power by promising to put America first, policies aimed at clawing back political, economic, and military power from China have become more popular on both sides of the aisle in Washington. The victory of Joe Biden in the presidential election is unlikely to change this. But how will it play out? To find out, I'm speaking to David Rees, an emerging markets economist at Schroders. We'll discuss how relations have soured, what actions both sides have taken, and what the likely outcome might be. But in the first part of the show, we're going to look at the story so far.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
So perhaps it's briefly worth recapping China-US economic relations. It's been a relatively recent rivalry, but David, would you mind telling us just how we've got to where we are today?
Yeah, sure. So I guess the story really begins in the late 1970s when China began to push through economic reforms under Deng. And this kind of really laid the foundations, if you like, for foreign investment. Now, it took quite a while for foreign investors to really begin to become interested in China. And FDI didn't really begin to accelerate until the 1990s. But that gradual interest from foreign investors in China began to accelerate. And really, after China joined the World Trade Organization in late 2001, which was supported at the time by the Clinton administration, inflows of foreign direct investment really accelerated as foreign companies, you know, including American companies, wanted to relocate manufacturing plants to China to take advantage of abundant and cheap and productive labor that was available there.
I came to China for the first time in maybe a quarter century ago. So that's the reason my hair is gray by now. And it's just been a sea change. I mean, you think about it now, some of the most modern cities in the world are in China. In the mid-90s, you wouldn't find any modern cities of the world here. The infrastructure that is going on.
So I guess that was really the start of the US-China relationship, if you like. And of course, for a time, it felt like everybody was a winner. China's economy was performing very strongly alongside export-led industrialization. It was also investing a lot in housing and infrastructure, which supported commodity producers. Export trade volumes at the world level increased, and that's obviously a strong driver of growth for emerging markets and economic regions like the Eurozone. And, you know, supply of cheap goods to the world from China at a time when credit was extremely easy to get hold of meant that, you know, the economies of the developed markets are also performing very well. So I guess, you know, for a time it felt like it was a really great relationship, but of course that all came tumbling down a little bit after the global financial crisis.
This is going to be one of the watershed days in financial markets history.
It was a manic Monday in the financial markets. The Dow tumbled more than 500 points after two pillars of the street tumbled over the weekend. Lehman Brothers, a 158-year-old firm, filed for bankruptcy.
Kind of jolted people to realize that China had actually gained a lot of employment and manufacturing employment from the West and from the US, and people start to question that, I guess.
So the economy's benefited, but have investors benefited as well?
Oh, yes. Certainly during the boom period in China, you know, that really underpins strong returns for investors. The boost to world trade is typically linked, particularly in emerging markets, to economic growth and also therefore corporate earnings. And that really gave a boost to, clearly, you know, valuations of equities, which performed very well in emerging markets and indeed developed markets. And we also saw strong performance in fixed income as well and currencies.
Okay, so we know that the US was encouraging of China and their growth. But going forward now, what are China's stated goals?
Well, if we look at the last round of policy announcements from China, we had a kind of a five-year plan and a longer-term plan. And the longer-term plan is to double the size of the economy by 2035.
And China says it needs annual growth of 4.7% to achieve its goal of doubling the economy by 2035. And its senior economic advisor says the nation possesses the conditions to meet that target despite the virus fallout and the global downturn. President Xi has said it's...
If they were to achieve that, it seems quite likely that they would actually overtake the U.S. as the world's largest economy in terms of just nominal GDP in US dollars, which is obviously a bit of a concern to the Americans, who are quite proud of their leadership of the world economy and the kind of political influence that comes with that. And also in the next 5 years, China has a stated policy aim, which is called dual circulation, which, you know, the details are still quite murky, but it seems to be a reiteration of past policies where the authorities want to try to rebalance the economy away from kind of export-led growth and relying on inputs from other countries to actually developing more of their own technologies and becoming more self-sufficient and moving up the value-added chain.
And Sri, the way it's trying to do that is through a yet-to-be-released plan that is going to be called China Standards 2035. It's broadly seen as a successor to the Made in China 2025 industrial plan, but with a bigger focus on technology and with the aim of dominating next-generation technologies like artificial intelligence.
And how likely do you think they are to achieve those goals?
Well, it won't be easy. As I said, they have had an aim of rebalancing the economy for some time, and each time there's an economic hiccup. Indeed, we've seen it during the COVID crisis. The way out of it is for the government to invest heavily, exacerbating old imbalances in the economy. So that won't be easy, and obviously it's not easy to develop high tech sectors which allow you to move up the value chain. But in terms of the overall growth numbers, in terms of doubling the size of the economy, that actually seems reasonably achievable. Quick back of the envelope estimates suggest they need an average annual GDP growth of around 4.5% year on year. And that's more or less in line with what we believe China's sort of potential growth rate over the next decade is. So in the short term, obviously, we're going to decelerate from rates of 6 5 to 6% probably next year, which would allow growth to kind of stabilize at around 4% further ahead in order to achieve those goals.
And does China have a debt problem?
Yes, absolutely. I don't think it's any secret that debt in China is too high. The latest data put it at around 275% of GDP in total, which is clearly an astronomical number, and it has increased substantially since the financial crisis by something in the region of 100 to 150% of GDP. Now, when emerging markets in the past have seen debt as a share of GDP rise by around just 30% of GDP over a decade, they've typically ended up in some kind of debt crisis. So according to that metric, it seems as though China is really skating on very thin ice. But of course, it's not the size of a debt that kills an economy, albeit can lead to misallocation of capital, but it's more the ability to service debt and sustain that debt position over the without suffering problems. And in that respect, China is somewhat of a special case, given that it quite often the authorities quite often have control over the lender and the borrower. And so we've typically seen in the past that it's been able to smooth over a lot of wobbles in debt.
China obviously taken some risks to get to where they are today, and it's certainly picked up a few ears in the US. So in part two, we'll look at what the issue is for the US and how the response, or what the response is from the rest of the world.
Get in touch with us by email at schroederspodcasts@schroeders.com or visit our website, schroeders.com/investor download.
So David, we've found out how we got to where we are today. What exactly is the US's main issue with China?
Well, part of the issue is that China threatens to dislodge America from its position as the world's largest economy. And with that typically goes a lot of political power and influence. But it, you know, China's also got ambitions to dislodge America's leadership in sectors such as technology. So we've seen, you know, the development of national champion companies, if you like, such as Huawei, which have been developing rapidly in telecommunications.
Actually, Huawei first developed its own chips back in 1991, and those chips can help Huawei in making better products by providing more cost-effective offerings, in thus making Huawei more competitive in the market. Therefore, we will continue.
And I guess one of the gripes that the Americans have is that they've got there by allegedly stealing intellectual property and not paying due respect, if you like, to the US and respecting those boundaries. So that's been a bit of a gripe as well. There's also somewhat of a feeling, particularly amongst the recent or past Trump administration, that China had gained an unfair advantage by blocking some American companies from its markets. Think of Google, for example, by imposing tariffs on foreign goods, and also by, you know, in the words of the Americans, manipulating its currency, or certainly the Trump administration manipulating its currency to keep the renminbi relatively cheap and gain an advantage against other exporters.
Earlier today, President Donald Trump labeled China a currency manipulator. China dropped the price, or allowed the price of their currency to fall to an almost historic low. Trump tweeted and he said...
Do you think they have a point?
Quite possibly. Well, there's no doubting, if you look at facts, that China does impose tariffs on imports. It has controlled and restricted access of some foreign companies to its markets to allow domestic operators to build up. And certainly it would be hard to argue that the renminbi is expensive. So you could argue that it's artificially cheap.
Okay, so what's been the response from the US so far?
Well, obviously there was a flurry of policies under the Trump administration across various different areas. So the most obvious one, which would stick in people's mind, was on trade and the imposition of trade tariffs.
We've taxed China on $300 billion worth of goods and products being sold into our country, and China eats it because...
So a succession of announcements by the Trump administration imposed tariffs, which ultimately ended up with some form of tariff in the region of 15 to 25% on most Chinese goods worth around $550 billion, albeit there was some rollback of that after the phase one trade agreement was struck in early 2020.
Today we take a momentous step, one that has never been taken before with China, toward a future of fair and reciprocal trade as we sign phase one of the historic trade deal between the United States and China.
There have also obviously been policies aimed at restricting the supply of U.S. patented technologies and goods to companies such as Huawei to impede their development, because Huawei's own technologies or onshore technologies are thought to lag behind significantly. We've also in the trade arena seen some pressure and incentives for companies, particularly strategic companies, to reshore production back to the US, with the idea of securing supply chains and preventing the alleged theft of intellectual property. And we've also seen measures imposed in the financial sector, so the threat of forcing Chinese companies to delist from American stock exchanges.
And what the Senate bill would do is it would require the exchanges to ban trading in the shares of a company that goes 3 years without inspection. It's highly unlikely that China is going to allow inspections of audits done in mainland China.
Measures aimed at or sanctions banning American investors from purchasing assets relating to Chinese companies with alleged links to the military, and also sanctions on individuals. So it's been quite a broad range of measures put in place by the Trump administration.
And how effective have those responses been?
Not very. I would say not particularly effective, to be honest. Certainly, it's hard to argue that trade tariffs have been a particularly potent weapon. So in the period when those tariffs were being imposed, China's exports to the US did decline, or China's share of the US export market did decline. However, its exports did perform quite strongly, and it actually increased ultimately its share of global exports or goods exports. And if you dig into the data, it seemed as though they were able to quite successfully reroute trade through third-party economies such as Taiwan, Vietnam, and Korea. And companies were also able to absorb some of the tariff increase into their margins, and the depreciation in the renminbi also helped. So I think the tariffs really weren't particularly successful. Similarly, it's hard to argue that so far incentives to on companies to relocate supply chains have been very successful. I mean, we have seen some headline-grabbing examples, such as the Taiwan Semiconductor Company agreeing to set up a manufacturing plant in Arizona with seemingly the offer of subsidies from the government and tax breaks. But on the whole, there hasn't been very much move. And indeed, if you look at surveys such as one conducted by the US-China Business Council, most companies have not and do not intend to move operations out of China, probably because it would be very costly, and it would risk losing access to the Chinese market, which is obviously a long-term growth story for many companies. You could argue perhaps that there's been more success in the ban of supplying components to companies like Huawei, although they were able to temporarily dodge that by hoarding inputs and building up inventories of inputs before the bans became effective. So I guess on the whole, that these measures haven't been particularly effective so far.
You mentioned China rerouting some of their trade through other parts of the world. That brings us nicely on to, where does the rest of the world stand in terms of the US's attitude towards China? Are they on board, or are they taking their own route?
Well, it's I mean, it's really hard to get a clear picture. There is definitely skepticism towards China in parts of Europe and parts of Asia. We've seen many countries rolling back the role of Huawei, for example, in use of their technologies in the telecommunications systems.
The government agrees with the National Cybersecurity Centre's advice. The best way to secure our networks is for operators to stop using new affected Huawei equipment to build the UK's future 5G networks.
We've seen trade spats as well, sometimes related to that, but you know, a lot of countries are feeling the pinch from China's emergence. But then at the same time, China has been able to strike a free trade deal in the Asia-Pacific region, the RCEP trade deal. And it's also been able to agree an investment deal with the EU. So on the one hand, everyone or most countries do seem to feel threatened by China, but at the same time, still want to work with them economically.
I suppose given the size of their population and potentially up and coming middle class, you don't really want to get on the wrong side of a nation the size of China. Would that probably be fair to say?
Absolutely, yeah. And we've seen, for example, with Australia. So Australia got into a bit of a political wrangle with the Chinese over Huawei and over Hong Kong. And then all of a sudden they've had problems exporting coal, which is one of their main sources of export revenues to China. We've also seen that in the past when there was a spat between South Korea and China over the THAAD missile system. And ultimately, the Chinese authorities leaned on consumers not to buy Korean cars, and those sales almost vanished overnight. And so, you know, China is a big market. It is going to get bigger over time, and the authorities aren't shy of flexing their muscles if people annoy them.
Now, you mentioned China's argument with Australia. The rhetoric's been quite strong, certainly around COVID. And certainly in the tone they've taken with the US. Did you see, now Biden's in power, do you see a slight softening of the tone between China and the US in particular?
I don't think so. I mean, clearly Biden is going to take a different approach to the one that was used by the Trump administration. I would expect him to really work in a more traditional way, if you like. Probably in a more multilateral and methodical way, rather than firing off, policy announcements on Twitter at 2 a.m. and catching investors and off guard and really rattling the markets. But I don't really see much reason for him to go soft on China. Certainly, if you look at some survey evidence, such as that from the Pew Center, which asks supporters of the Republican Party and the Democrat Party, if they have a positive or negative view of China. I mean, it's no surprise that most Republicans report that they have a negative view, but also the majority of Democrat supporters also share that view. And so the tough stance against China is popular on both sides of the island in Washington. And so it really wouldn't make much sense for Biden to soften that. I think so far we can see that dealing with China isn't necessarily the top of his list of priorities. In his inauguration speech, he didn't really mention China at all. And so far is focusing on domestic issues. And I think if we think about the disruptions we saw in Washington around the time of the US election, that's understandable. And so efforts are really going into getting a fiscal stimulus done. But he has been talking about that fiscal stimulus, making an effort to purchase US goods. So there's clearly still protectionism there. And probably he will start to focus on China again later this year and into next year.
OK, so naturally there will be those that benefit and those that don't from this standoff between China and the US. And that's what we'll be looking at in the final part of the show. The winners and losers based on three scenarios. Okay, so you've written a rather long piece for us, which we'll put a link to in the show notes, but you break down three scenarios for us. Can you just give us a a brief highlight of what they are and the potential outcomes, both winners and losers. So let's start with the no escalation. So Biden sticks with the current policies and the current rhetoric with the way they are.
Yes, and I think that, and I think this is probably the most likely outcome, that he won't roll back many policies or any policies, but at the same time he might not escalate them significantly, certainly in the short term. And you know, aside from the removal of all kind of trade barriers, this is probably the most positive outcome for the global economy and financial markets. Clearly, we've now become used to trade tariffs. Markets have taken it in their stride and have pushed on to all-time highs despite that. So I guess, you know, that's a pretty good outcome in the short term. In the longer term, the persistent imposition of tariffs might start to have more of a noticeable impact on trade and economic activity, particularly I would guess in the low value manufacturing sector in China, where margins are pretty thin and companies over time would obviously prefer not to suffer from tariffs. So you could easily imagine that some companies would start to relocate. When I did a kind of brief investigation into which markets would be attractive, it was really, you know, places like India and Indonesia which stuck out, because they have large working age populations and labor is relatively abundant and quite cheap. And we've also latterly seen some moves to start pushing through labor market reforms, which should help. Now, if these emerging markets are successful in attracting some manufacturing from China, it could potentially have some pretty significant macroeconomic implications over time, which would also be a benefit for investors, because by building up export-led in manufacturing, emerging markets are able to boost economic growth, they're able to boost productivity growth, and they're also able to improve their external positions. Indeed, India and Indonesia are two economies where bouts of faster growth tend to see current account deficits emerge, and ultimately this puts a brake on economic activity, and also leaves financial markets more vulnerable to bouts of volatility. So if they are able to start shifting their economic models more towards manufacturing exports, then not only would you see faster economic growth, but you would see declines in structural interest rates, credit spreads, better returns and more stable returns on equity, and less volatile currencies. So that could be a positive story if it were to really materialize over the longer term. And, you know, China could also benefit from that too if it were to shed some lower end manufacturing, because, you know, they have the stated aim of increasing the size of their economy, and the easiest way for them to do that, and also rebalancing the economy, I should say, and the easiest way for them to do that is to move further up the value added chain in manufacturing to generate jobs that are highly productive and increase incomes for workers. And so if shedding low-end manufacturing meant that people could move from relatively poorly paid jobs to better paid jobs, then that could also help China in its economic development in the long term.
Okay, and what happens if there's a broad escalation of the tensions between the two countries?
Yes, so this is a bit of a concern for us, because while the trade war to this date has centered on tariffs, it hasn't really got into more severe measures. So China's response so far has been quite muted, but an escalation might see it start to place foreign companies on export control lists. So in effect, banning foreign companies from exporting their goods that are made in China. It could also start to put companies on unreliable entity lists, and so block more companies from operating in China. And also, you know, if there were even more punitive tariffs imposed by the US, or if it actually just insisted that companies using US technologies or US companies had to move out of China, then we would really be moving more into the realms of deglobalization. And so where globalization in recent decades has been a positive force for global growth, and help to reduce global inflation and interest rates, any policies which started to unpick that more severely would start to work in the opposite direction. So you might see lower trade volumes, lower global growth, higher inflation, and higher structural interest rates. So that could be a pretty negative scenario in the longer term. And you would think that at the margin, or relative to a baseline, that would also have a negative impact on the performance of financial markets. If we were to think about the emerging markets, there would be still some winners. Probably the greatest winner would expect to be Mexico, if there was really a reshoring and a breaking up of supply chains, because Mexico obviously enjoys a free trade deal with the US. Which would be very attractive to any companies relocating. But on the negative side, I guess anything to break up globalization would weigh on the economic performance and the performance of markets in those countries which have benefited most from globalization. So you'd be thinking about relatively small export dependent economies and markets such as Korea, which have done very well in recent years.
What happens if all relations are broken off?
Well, pandemonium, I think, is the short answer. If we really move to a kind of almost Cold War scenario, then you would end up with two discrete supply chains and business cycles, if you like, in the world. One centering around China. You would think, given the efforts it's made through initiatives like the Belt and Road, that it would try to pull in those allies around itself and to build supply chains and around itself in that way. And then you would expect to see another market or economy centered around the US and perhaps Europe. Now, that would really in the long term be pretty disastrous, I would say, for the performance of the global economy. So you'd expect much weaker economic growth, structurally higher inflation as globalization and those positive effects are completely unwound, and really very, very volatile and poor performance in financial markets, particularly you would think in emerging markets.
Of those three scenarios, which do you think at the moment is the most likely?
Well, thankfully, I think scenario one is the most likely now that President Biden has taken over. I think if we had another Trump presidency, then the omens were not good. He would have probably taken that as a mandate to become even more hawkish on China. And we certainly saw him firing off a flurry of executive orders before leaving office. So that would have, I think, really increased the probabilities of scenario two. But as I said, with a Biden administration, a more methodical, a more multilateral approach, I think that skews the probabilities more towards scenario one, which is obviously a relatively good outcome if it happens.
Here's what else investors are talking about. Trust in governmental institutions is at a record low across the world, according to the latest Edelman survey. The longer the pandemic has lasted, the more disillusioned people have become with the leaders they put their faith in. So who can we turn to trust? There's one institution that's considered both ethical and competent. Business. Find out why that is good for the social contract and investors by reading Catherine Davidson's article, Trust Me, I'm a Chief Executive, on schroders.com/insights. Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out more, you can go to schroders.com/theinvestor download. There you can listen to our back catalogue and read related articles. If you want to contact us about anything in the show, email us at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. You can rate, review and subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every Thursday and every Monday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.